a great Buddha will have in him a touch of regret that life is fleeting. Because if he doesn't have that touch of regret, he's not human, and he is incapable of compassion towards people who regret very much that life is fleeting. So the mood aware is that touch of regret, of nostalgia, of, you know that poem which speaks of the feeling of a banquet hall deserted. Here it is, there's been a great banquet, you know, and it's all the guests have gone home, and there are empty glasses and dirty plates and crushed napkins and all sorts of things all over, and somehow the echo of voices and merriment is still there. And so this mood, aware, comes up. So even a very great person should feel that, because the price otherwise is not to be human. So for this reason, Buddhist and Taoist poetry is not unemotional. It's not dehumanized, and so somehow speaks very much to us as people, and does not have in it the feeling that we ought instead to turn into saints or supermen. That's the humane thing about this philosophy of life. The next word, the special term, is furyu. Furyu means literally wind flow. Fu is the character for wind. Ryu means flowing. And the dictionaries translate it elegance, and this won't do. Furyu, first of all, you must remember that the word wind is used in Chinese and Japanese alike to indicate atmosphere. The atmosphere of a place. So when a person has, say, a certain school of poetry or philosophy, it's called the family wind. That means the atmosphere, the slant, the attitude of this particular school. So that meaning of wind, atmosphere, comes into the expression furyu. And furyu is like this. Here is a man fishing, and he's sitting in the evening, in the twilight, on the edge of a river with his fishing rod in a lonely little boat tied up by the bank. Now, if this man is fishing with his mind intent simply on catching fish, this is not furyu. But if he's also digging the atmosphere, it's furyu. To flow with the wind, you see, to dig the atmosphere. American offers the most beautiful possibilities of translation in our incomparable slang for some Oriental ideas. Furyu is to get with it, to flow with it. And not again, you see, in the sense of the merely passive leaf flowing on the wind. But furyu has in it, you see, a touch of self-consciousness, like that man fishing. Now, you would think, if you studied Taoist philosophy, that this would be very bad. Zhuangzi somewhere says that a comfortable belt is one that you don't feel, and you're unaware of it. That's not the most comfortable belt. Like comfortable shoes, would you be completely unconscious of comfortable shoes? No. Something better than comfortable shoes are shoes that you know are comfortable. So, in the same way, self-consciousness adds something to life. It's one thing to be happy and not know it. It's another thing to be happy and to know it. It's like one's voice in a shower room or bathtub has more resonance. And that's why temples and cathedrals and resonating boxes for guitars and drums and things are created, to give this little quality of echo. For all echo is a certain kind of feedback which enables you to reflect upon what you are doing and to know that you know. So one might say that ordinary people are Buddhas, but they don't know it. And a Buddha is one who knows he's a Buddha. Only, they don't let you settle for this comfortably and easily, because really to know is also defined as not to know. In the Upanishads, it is said that if you think that you know what Brahman is, you have yet some study to be done. For those who know Brahman do not know Brahman, and those who do not know Brahman really know. Now, all this paradoxical language is intended to keep you confused, so that you can't say, I've got it. So, but this position, you see, is not one-sided. There is something about being human, about being self-conscious, that is not a mistake of nature, not a completely evil fall into self-awareness. But self-awareness, although it creates all kinds of problems, because through self-awareness, the human being is in some sense a self-frustrating mechanism. He knows that he's going to die. And the price of being able to control the future is to know that in the long run you won't be able to, and worry about that. But also, with self-consciousness goes the possibility of resonance, of realization, of becoming enlightened, liberated, and knowing it, and therefore able to enjoy it. So, Furyu adds to the dimension of going with it something more than the mere passivity of going with, but knowing that you're going. But it does at the same time, it isn't entirely wrong that the dictionaries have translated it elegance. You could say Furyu is style. When we say somebody really has style. Now, but this designates a particular kind of style. It is the style of what one might call the elegant poor man, the aristocratic bum, the rich pauper, you see. Now, you find that a good deal in the things that we've been seeing. We've gone to many temples where nobody really owns anything, and yet in a way they're luxurious. This is Furyu. The next word is Yugen. I have spoken about Yugen, but I haven't told you. The basic symbol of Yugen is the flower which grows from a rock. And so there is something about that which is improbable, mysterious, contradictory, that a flower could come out of a rock. Yugen, more than any other of these terms, defies translation. The two characters, which I shall draw for you shortly, are rather interesting. One, the first character, Yu, shows the basic form of a mountain. And then the mountain is combined with characters indicating darkness. You see, in the character for mountain, which is simply like this, there are these things here that are the valleys, and the dark is put in the valley, you see, in each case. Now, you get the idea of the deep valley. There's a poem which says, the wind drops, but the petals keep falling. The bird calls, and the mountain becomes more mysterious. Little sounds emphasizing silence. Little motions emphasizing stillness. This quality, you see, is in this word yu. Gen is in Chinese xuan, which means the original deep, deep, mysterious darkness out of which everything arises. The depth. And darkness covered the face of the deep, or the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Those waters of chaos, the primeval blackness, which is the same blackness as your head. You know how your head appears invisible to your eyes. That is Gen. It is darker than darkness, blacker than black. It is practically nothingness. It's so mysterious. So when you put these two characters together, you get Yugen. And so Yugen is, first of all, suggestiveness. I was looking round one of the temples a few days ago, where I noticed that you couldn't figure out how big it was. Or it didn't seem to have any limits. Because always every wall, say of a room, seemed to be a screen which led to something else beyond. And at the back of every garden there seemed to be a little gate that led to some other courtyard. And everything led into something else. And I said to the priest, I don't know whether I'm going to go exploring or not, or just leave it alone. And think that, well, here I left Kyoto and I never did find out what was through that little gate. And so what? Forever there will be magic behind there, which I didn't define, I didn't draw in. And so this whole temple was done that way. All sorts of suggestions of little avenues disappearing, like a mountain path winding up among the trees. Where does it go? True, if you follow it. You'll eventually go up out of Kyoto here and get down to Otsu. And who knows, you'll find yourself back in the suburbs. But there is the sense with that disappearing mountain path, like we've got going up here, that it goes to the place. And everybody has in their back of their minds an image of the place that you want to go to. Or some, not really an image though, it's always slightly indefinite. There's the certain feeling of there ought to be somewhere the thing I've always wanted. We get disappointed, of course, because as we get older we feel that perhaps that doesn't exist at all. That one just has to put up with the second best or with something. Half a loaf is better than no bread. But still, I find that Far Eastern art is very, very full of hints about what is sometimes called Horaisan. Horaisan is the magical island somewhere out in the Pacific, which is the Paradise Island. And all these Chinese paintings of wonderful floating pagodas and terraces with scholars sitting around drinking wine and so on are hints of the paradise world. And that somewhere then these little steps lead up to that thing. And you've seen these steps. Japan is full of them. As you just go along in the train, you look up the hills, and there are arches, torii, steps disappearing into the hills, all of which suggest the feeling, somewhere up there is that thing. So Yugen, as it were, comes round full circle to Sabi. The wonderful lonely place at the end of the road where there won't be any mother-in-law to bother you, any that sort of dreadful social difficulty, but the solitude which befits a bearded old gentleman Now, of course, you see, all these things are symbols. On one level, they're very human, and they reflect our perhaps childish and immature desires to be really alone, to have that paradise thing. And realistic people say, well, you ought not to bother yourself or fool yourself with such fantasies. And nowadays I find that we feel very guilty about thinking of paradise, of horizon, or whatever it is, the enchanted garden. We think, nuh-uh. Reality is what you read about in the newspapers, and you've got to face it. And everything is unpleasant, basically. I know there's the hard-boiled school of zoologists, for example, who insist that birds hate flying. You know, everybody has always envied a bird and wanted to be able to glide along with wings, you know. And so there comes up somebody, who's usually some wretched academician, who says, no, we've discovered by measurements that birds loathe flying. You must feel very satisfactory when you found that out, because you've smashed an ideal. Oh, for the wings of a dove. Far away would I roam. In the wilderness, build me a nest, and remain there forever at rest. I'm quoting the Psalms. But apparently doves just hate this chore of flying. Now, it is just in the same way as it's ridiculous to try to be so inhuman as never to feel any regrets about the passing of time and of life, and so on. It's likewise inhuman not to have the paradise fantasy of the mysterious place round the corner, just over the crest of the hill, just behind the island in the distance, you see? Because that place is really the big joke. That's you. That's why you have found that at the end of the line, when you get through the last torii and up the last stairway, you are liable to be confronted with a mirror. And so everybody is seeking for that thing that you've got to have, you see. Well, you got it. But nobody's going to believe this. But there it is, the real thing that you are is the paradise land that you're looking for at the end of the line. And it's far, far more reliable than any kind of an external scene which you could love and cling to and hold on to. But of course, the whole fascination of life is that seems perfectly incredible.
Your It continues with Session 7, An Introduction to Hinduism.
Now, today I am going to go into the very fundamental guts of Hinduism. But what I want to do is to begin with certain documents that are known as the Upanishads. Upanishad, or plural, Upanishad. A word which means something like initiatic instruction, freely translated. And these documents constitute what is called Vedanta, V-E-D-A-N-T-A, and that is compounded of two words, Veda, Anta. Anta means end or completion or summation. Veda, of course, is related to the Latin video, to see. Veda is the fundamental revelation of the Hindu way of life contained in its earliest scriptural documents,
which are generally dated in the period between 1500 and 1200 BC. The Upanishads, as being the summation of the Veda, are found from